I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome back to Radio Times. Our guest, Nathaniel Philbrick, says that Benedict Arnold's treason did more to bring the country together than his victories on the battlefield. His new book is titled Valiant Ambition, George Washington, Benedict Arnold, and the Fate of the American Revolution. It's about Washington and Arnold's complex relationship on and off the battlefield, a dysfunctional Congress that mistrusted the military and fought with each other, and a public worn down by conflict and war. Philbrick writes that Benedict Arnold was a skilled and ambitious general who felt betrayed and belittled by his country and chose to fight for the British for a number of complicated reasons. Nathaniel Philbrick was a guest on the show a couple of years ago when his book Bunker Hill was published, and he joins us once again on Radio Times. Nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
It's great to be back.
We were talking about the musical Hamilton before going on the air. How much, as a historian of the American Revolution, how much do you think Hamilton has gotten the public interested, even fired up, learning about our past?
It's such a phenomenon, and I was lucky enough to see it this winter. And, you know, it's magical what it does, making the past so immediate and these historical characters so accessible and so human. And, you know, the tonal shifts throughout, it's just fascinating. And, it's really changed the landscape when it comes to history and popular culture.
Well, I have to say, I saw it as well. And as I was reading your book, I was thinking, gosh, musical about Benedict Arnold. I think that might work.
Well, who knows?
He certainly is an interesting enough person.
Sure, absolutely. Especially, you know, with his relationship with his wife, Peggy. It is a very interesting relationship.
Well, I do want to get to all of that, but let's begin where your book begins.
Yes.
And it's September, it's 1776. The Continental Army is in retreat. The British naval fleet is essentially sort of moved in, this enormous fleet of ships, terrifying number of ships.
Oh, it's 400 vessels, you know, close to 40,000 men. This made it bigger than Philadelphia. You know, more people than Philadelphia, the largest urban center in North America, were on these warships in New York Harbor. It was, you know, something like the War of the Worlds, where this huge force arrives, and people were astounded. And there's Washington with the Continental Army, ill-trained, ill-equipped, and he's on an island, on two islands, Long Island and Manhattan, where they're surrounded by warships. So he really didn't have much of a chance, but Washington was a fighter. Unfortunately, the Battle of Long Island would not go well for him. He would be completely outgeneraled by William Howe, his British counterpart, forced to evacuate to New York and then eventually into the Harlem Heights and completely off Manhattan.
Did the British, I mean, what's interesting is that it seems as if the British wanted to negotiate. I mean, they had
absolutely
400 ships, but in the service of some kind of diplomacy.
Well, it's interesting. William Howe, who was the British general, was backed up by the admiral, his brother, older brother Richard Howe. And the Howes had a real affection for America. Their older brother had died in the French and Indian War in the arms of Israel Putnam, one of the American generals in the Revolution, and the colony of Massachusetts had built a memorial for him in Westminster Abbey. And they really felt that the best way to settle this dispute with the colonies was not to crush Washington's army, but to force him into negotiation. And you could argue that the Howes were the best asset the Americans had at the beginning, because here he had this huge force completely capable of crushing Washington. And Washington gave him plenty of chances, but always Howe would relent in the hopes that there would be he could settle this thing. And, of course, Washington would eventually slip through his fingers.
You mentioned that George Washington was really ill-prepared to take on the British. In fact, you say in this book he was a backwoodsman at heart.
Yeah, well, he had grown up as a surveyor and is initially served in the French and Indian War out in the wilds of western Pennsylvania. And that was his experience. He had no experience leading a large army in battle, and really no American general did. Mm-hmm. And so that it wasn't his best hour. In fact, it was his worst hour. And the important thing strategically that happened for the British was it gave them a toehold on the Hudson River,
right,
because this was the waterway that if you went up the Hudson River, past Albany, and then took a short hitch over to Lake Champlain, this was a waterway more than 100 miles long that with a river-like extension into Canada. And so this was a time when overland travel was very slow. Water was how you traveled. And all the British had to do was come down from Canada on Lake Champlain, take Fort Ticonderoga, the southern tip of that lake, and then they had the Hudson River already, and it would be over. They would have succeeded in cutting New England off from the rest of the colonies.
But they had to deal with this guy named Benedict Arnold,
That's
who
right.
you say was a really skilled military person.
Absolutely. You know, so fast forward a couple of weeks, there's another British invasionary force coming down from Canada, down from Lake Champlain under the leadership of General Carleton. And it's an armada. They've got, even though they're on a lake, they've got a three-masted ship with 18 cannons, you know, schooners, gunships, and it's only Arnold with a ragtag fleet of 15 boats that he's actually built that summer.
Like rowboats, weren't
right,
they?
Right, rowboats with a sail on them, really floating platforms for cannons. And it was Arnold was the only thing between the British completely dividing New England from the rest of the colonies. And what would unfold just a few miles south of modern Plattsburgh, New York, would be the Battle of Valcour Island. Arnold would position his fleet inside this little island. The British would sail past the island. Arnold would say, hey, I'm over here. And what he had done was give himself what is known as the weather gauge. They had to sail up to him. And so he negated, in a very real way, the advantage they had because their big square-rigged ships couldn't sail against the wind. And so for the next 8 hours, his 15 ships would trade cannon fire with the 20 or more gunboats of the British, just wail on each other. And night would fall. One of Arnold's vessels had been sunk. A lot of people injured, but he had battled them to a draw. He would be able to escape that night, sneak out, and eventually make his way down to Fort Ticonderoga. The British were like, wow, what was this tornado that hit us? And they decided, well, you know, they looked at their calendar and they said, you know, it's getting kind of late. Maybe it's a little late to take Fort Ticonderoga. We'll save it till next year. And Arnold had done it. He had prevented the British from taking this waterway, from winning the war. And a year later would be the Battle of Saratoga, which would be a famous victory. And it was all set up by Benedict Arnold.
I mean, talk about asymmetrical warfare, right? You've got these gigantic
Absolutely.
British schooners or ships or of some sort up against 15 robots.
Yeah, and this was Arnold's genius. There was no one in either the American or British Army who could take the measure of an enemy quicker. He was not a very good maritime leader, but he was also great on land. He could read topography in an amazing way, and he was a fighter. He only knew all-out attack. He was a risk taker, and 9 times out of 10, those risks would work for him.
In fact, you say he was a natural-born mariner, maybe more comfortable on the sea than on land, because it sounds like Benedict Arnold was also a difficult person to deal with.
He was what made him great in the battle situation, made him difficult when there wasn't the musket balls were not flying.
Kind of my way or the highway kind of guy?
Yes, he didn't suffer fools easily. He was always, if there was a politician involved, he had a hard time cooling it down. He also was in constant arguments with his fellow officers. And so controversy always followed him. And it was just a part of his makeup.
He had a relationship. Did he and George Washington have some things in common? Because I remember
Absolutely.
Reading about Washington's temper.
Yeah, well, you know, we think of Washington as the guy on the $1 bill. That's Washington in old age. Washington, during the Revolution, was in his 40s, red-haired, fiery. He was, by temperament, aggressive. He would learn to channel that aggression as the Revolution progressed and fight a largely defensive war, but that wasn't his natural temperament. I think Washington, if he had been 10 years younger, he would have been very much a Benedict Arnold figure. And I think there's a good sense, you know, I think he identified with Arnold and perhaps even envied him. You know, this could have been me if I wasn't saddled with the crushing burden of command. And so I think they had a real similarity and a real affection for one another.
Your book is full of all sorts of interesting little tidbits. One of them that George Washington used to crack walnuts with his teeth and yes. I guess paid the price for that.
Well, yeah, you know, I think there's really speaks to the tensions that this guy is dealing with. You know, he's not chewing gum. He's cracking walnuts with his teeth. And unfortunately, they would crack his teeth and he would famously require dentures later in life. But that's the amazing thing about Washington. He was a passionate man, but he had learned to, for the most part, control those passions. Arnold was different. He would never be able to control those passions. They were just a part of his makeup.
And what was the relationship between the two?
Well, you know, they never spent much time together. But Washington had real respect for him. And not long after the Battle of Valcour Island, in that winter, Arnold would be looked over for promotion by the Continental Congress. And Washington was very upset on Arnold's behalf. You know, it was a political appointment. Arnold was the most deserving brigadier general. He should have been promoted. And he would write this amazing letter to Arnold where he would Arnold was at that point in Providence with hopes of attacking the British that had then moved into Newport, Rhode Island. And he says in this letter to Arnold, he first consoles him on the fact that he didn't get a promotion, but look, I'm working for you. But also, when it comes to the British, don't attack unless you have a moral certainty of victory. And it's interesting. He knows Arnold's temperament, I think in large part because it's his own. And I think he's trying to talk both himself and Arnold into a more defensive mode that is better for America in this war.
You write that the Continental Congress at this time was very mistrustful of the military, and I guess for some obvious reasons. But
yeah.
What was the basis for
that? Well,
I
think, you know, a lot of us think that Washington had free rein when it came to fighting this.
Short leash, it seems.
Yeah, but it was just the opposite. Remember, we were fighting to create a republic, and a republic, the civil government controls the military. And in every revolution prior to this, what would happen is the revolution would begin with the best of intentions, but inevitably in the chaos that followed the revolution, the military would co-opt civil government, whether it was Caesar, whether it was Cromwell, and in the future, Napoleon, crowning himself emperor. And so the Continental Congress was rightfully distrustful of that this might happen. And as a consequence, they were second-guessing Washington all the time. They reserved the right to appoint major generals. Can you imagine it? Here's the people upon whom Washington depends the most. He can't pick. And so they had decided in their wisdom that each state should have two major generals. And since Connecticut, Arnold's home state, already had two, they would overlook their best brigadier general. And you know, others suffered a similar fate and would simply quit the military. It's a tribute to Washington that he was able to hold it all together.
Well, let's take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation talking with Nathaniel Philbrick about his new book. It's called Valiant Ambition, George Washington, Benedict Arnold, and the Fate of the American Revolution. Much more after this very short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen, and if you're just joining us, Nathaniel Philbrick is our guest. He's written a number of books about the founding of this country, the early years of the American Revolution, of America itself, including In the Heart of the Sea, which won the National Book Award, Mayflower, a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize, Bunker Hill, winner of the New England Book Award, Sea of Glory, and he's got a new book called Valiant Ambition, George Washington, Benedict Arnold, and the Fate of the American Revolution. 1-888-477-9499 to join the conversation. Let's talk a little bit about the Continental Congress, because as you describe it, it has a familiar ring to it in that there was a degree of dysfunction and infighting and partisanship. I guess fighting over essentially the role of the government, the role of the federal government, the role of the states.
Absolutely. I mean, we're still struggling to define, you know, what is the proper portion of power. And, you know, the Continental Congress at this time did not have the power to directly tax the people. And here they were trying to fight a war, had to fund an army and you know, pay their bills. And they began by printing money, which was a quick solution early on, but that soon began to plummet in value. And they were broke. And so and what drove Washington crazy was, you know, we think of the Continental Congress as we think of it in 1776 with the Declaration of Independence, when there were giants like John Adams, Jefferson, Benjamin Franklin. Well, the fact of the matter is, soon after the Declaration of Independence, they all left. And a second and third and fourth tier delegates came in, and many of the states didn't even supply the number of people that they could. And so the whole American government just seemed to not really care what was going on. And instead of grappling these issues that were really important, they began to fight over partisanship. It's nothing new. And there was a radical element in New England, a group of New England delegates aligning with Virginians who had a deep mistrust of the military, and Washington in particular. And, you know, you'd think Washington's success at Trenton and Princeton would have won him their support. No, it made people like John Adams very deeply suspicious that he was approaching monarchical proportions, and these people were wired to bring down monarchs, and so it was almost a knee-jerk reaction. And then you had the more conservative delegates from the middle states, from New York, who were trying to support Washington. The real thing was that there was a philosophical problem with having a standing army. The radicals feared that if you had a professional army, it was just waiting to take over the civil government. But Washington said, "I can't fight a professional army without one." And so, you know, they were constantly struggling back and forth what was best for the country.
Well, and you can see the arguments on both sides.
Absolutely. You know, and if for a good Republican, the militia was the way to go. They were cheap. You'd bring them up when you needed them, and then they'd go back to their farms or whatever afterwards. But the fact of the matter is, they did not have the discipline to stand up to the British troops. And so this was the beginning of our country. This is the moment of Genesis, and it's not pretty. People are struggling over how to define this country. And, you know, the fact that we're still struggling over it shows you how fundamental those issues were.
You write, the passage of the Declaration of Independence had forced Americans to make a choice, either side with the newly created United States or declare their continued loyalty to the British king. And so while representatives or leadership or the third string were fighting in the Continental Congress, the public was also in conflict over
Absolutely.
This war and with each other.
You're right. And there was a real civil war going on. And what was happening was, you know, we think of the Revolution as the stepping stones to victory. The reality is, it went on for 8 years. It became mired in this directionless slog, and as the war seemed to lose all coherence, it broke down into these very local struggles, particularly around New York and here in Philadelphia, where you had the hardliners, the radicals, and here in Philadelphia they were called constitutionalists. That, you know, you had to express your loyalty to our government, or you were under suspicious. Then there were the more conservative people who just said, "Hey, relax here. You know, let's you know, there are people of varying enthusiasms for this." And so it meant that more energy was being put into Americans fighting one another than fighting what was termed British tyranny.
In fact, you say, just to underscore what you just said, that there was a civil war going on inside the American Revolutionary War.
Absolutely. And it was happening in Westchester County, north of British-occupied New York, in the Long Island and the coastal New Jersey. They were suffering the whaleboat wars, where gangs of so-called patriots would descend upon their former neighbors loyalty was in question, and attack and literally ravage their families. Mm-hmm. And it was just ugly. This is the dark underbelly of the revolution, and it was very disturbing to all involved, and people like Benedict Arnold, who had were already disaffected with Congress, were watching. Many were concerned that this country, if Washington should somehow win this war, would there be a country left to claim victory?
Well, let's talk about Benedict Arnold and the famous Battle of Saratoga.
Yeah. I mean, the Battle of Saratoga was his finest and darkest hour, really. This was a battle that had been set up by Arnold through the Battle of Valcour Island. He was serving under Horatio Gates, who had been his friend. But Gates was a political animal. And prior to Trenton, he had been angling to sort of take over from Washington. And he feared that Arnold was going to take a lot of his glory at the Battle of Saratoga, because what was happening is John Burgoyne had come down that water highway, taken Fort Ticonderoga, and was now on the Hudson working his way to Albany. But he was running out of provisions. The American wilderness was running him down. And meanwhile, thousands of American militiamen and Continental soldiers were descending, were moving towards what would become the Battle of Saratoga on Bemis Heights along the Hudson River. And it was looking pretty good. And Horatio Gates was very defensive-minded. Arnold was attack. And they were soon at loggerheads. And there were actually two battles on the Battle of Saratoga, the Battle of Freeman's Farm, and it would be Arnold's soldiers that would basically win that battle, if not win it technically, at least battle the British to a draw. But the British suffered terrible injuries. It was close to going down. And in the weeks after that, Arnold and Gates had a terrible falling out. Arnold was basically expelled from the army, but he stuck around.
Yeah.
And for the last battle, the Battle of Bemis Heights, and even though he was not technically a part of the army, he appeared on the battlefield, an extraordinarily charismatic figure. Soldiers just magnetically followed him around, and towards the end of it, he realized there's a way to end this. There was a redoubt that was essential to the British defenses, and he saw a way to take it. And so he took off with several soldiers following in his wake, came through the sally port, the entrance to this enemy redoubt, and shouted, he was on his horse, shouted, "Surrender." A German soldier lifted his musket, fired. The ball went through his leg, killed his horse. He fell down. The horse pinned him to the ground, and he was horribly injured.
You have a quote here that he rode that day, quote, "more like a madman than a cool and discreet officer at a full gallop back and forth." I mean, this telling us how he was as a leader on the field.
Absolutely passionate. There was an element of clarity in that. Early on in the battle, he realized that there was a British officer on the right side of the British line that was absolutely essential to holding the integrity of the enemy line. And he told a sharpshooter, "Take that guy out." Mm. They took that guy out. It took three shots to do it. But when he fell, the British fell. And so, Arnold was criticized for being a crazy man, but Arnold was extraordinarily talented. And then he suffers this terrible traumatic injury at the end. And someone who had served with him before, Henry Dearborn from New Hampshire, came up to him and he said, "Are you okay?" And he said, "I wish that musket ball had gone through my heart."
And killed him.
Yes. And given what would happen in the future, if he had died there, he would have died one of our greatest heroes.
Well, I think we know how it goes, but let me just quickly reintroduce you. Nathaniel Philbrick is our guest. He's got a new book called Valiant Ambition, George Washington, Benedict Arnold, and the Fate of the American Revolution. And we got a bunch of comments here at radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. You write that it really was this battle. He got wounded, in a sense wished that he had died, that was an important turning point for Benedict Arnold, and perhaps began to see with this Continental Congress the fact that he wasn't going to get the kind of credit he thought he deserved on the battlefield, that perhaps he didn't want to fight for this fledgling America.
Well, you know, it was the beginning of his slow descent into treachery. He was a man. He was an athlete. His physicality was absolutely essential to who he was, and he was basically had lost his left leg. It would be years before he could even ride a horse. Again, he couldn't walk. He spent months in a hospital bed with the equivalent of a medieval torture device, a fracture box around his broken leg. Wow. And he began to brood. Much of his anger was directed towards Horatio Gates, who he called the greatest poltroon in the world.
Poltroon, a terrific word.
And Gates would go from that battle down to Philadelphia, where Washington had lost Philadelphia and was in, besieged in Valley Forge, and Gates would there would be members in Congress who were trying to dislodge Washington with Gates, and so there is so both men were suffering their own torments, but for Arnold it was different. This really began to mess with his head. He had given everything to his country, his body, his personal wealth. Much of it had gone towards this, and what did he have left? And so he began to decide after this that it was time for him to begin to look for himself. He needed to make back some of that money that Congress was unable to pay him for his time as a soldier.
Well, he also had a co-conspirator, or perhaps an enabler, the woman he married, Peggy Shippen.
Yes, Peggy Shippen, because Arnold would make his way to Philadelphia. He would actually take the loyalty oath at Valley Forge with his hand on the Bible held by Henry Knox. And then Washington, because Arnold could no longer fight in battle, appointed him military governor of Philadelphia. Now, to be a military governor of a war-torn city requires tact.
Yeah.
Arnold had not an ounce of that, and he was soon surrounded in controversy, embroiled in battles with political leaders of Pennsylvania, Joseph Reed, with the Continental Congress. He aligned himself with the more conservatives who were being marginalized by the newly energized lower orders, Democratic majority, and he met this beautiful girl. He was 36, a widower, and there was 18-year-old Peggy Shippen.
And she was quite beautiful.
She was gorgeous, and we know that because a British officer, Major John Andre, during the British occupation of Philadelphia, had befriended her and did a wonderful sketch of her. She's quite the attractive.
Something.
Yes, and Arnold fell in love, and Peggy came from a family that prior to the Revolution had been very much a part of the British superstructure of the colonies, and she, not necessarily a loyalist, but with loyalist leanings. And she greatly sympathized with the torments that Arnold had suffered, not only on the battlefield, but now by the politicians. They got married, and I don't think it's an accident that within a month, Arnold would send out his first feelers to the British. And who did he contact but none other than Major John Andre, who was now in New York and had become the high control of the British spy network.
A little sidebar. Benedict Arnold liked the ladies, the ladies liked him.
A little bit about. He was a ladies' man, and prior to meeting Peggy, he had fallen in love with an even younger girl, a 16-year-old loyalist girl in Boston, Deborah DeBlois, who he had written these purple prose, they're just amazing, and to show you the kind of guy Arnold was when he met Peggy, when he wrote a letter to her, an equally passionate letter, what he did was he just copied two paragraphs from the earlier letter. It had not worked with the previous girl who spurned his overtures, but it certainly worked for Peggy.
Yeah. So do you think? I mean. Did she plant the seed, do you think, his betrayal?
I think he was, already he had decided it was time he made some money out of this war. And he used his position as military governor to secretly put together some business deals that were shady, to say the least. But, you know, he still revered Washington. He was conflicted about this. And yet, you know, when you marry someone, I don't care who you are, that person has a deep influence upon you. And clearly, you know, Peggy began to have more and more of an influence.
Let me read a tweet. Why did Philadelphia politicians dislike Arnold while he lived in Philadelphia before he switched sides? And was it what you said earlier, that he was just a very difficult person to deal with?
Right. Well, Philadelphia was divided deeply. You know, we were talking about the Civil War. Well, it was being fought in Philadelphia, literally, where the militiamen in Philadelphia became kind of the strong arm of the radical element. Because Pennsylvania had the most radical constitution in the United States, it was complete majority rule, no governor, just the legislature, and there were no checks and balances to protect the minorities, who now the wealthy were in the minorities, as were the Quakers. And one of the things Joseph Reed, who would become the head of the executive council of the legislature, would do is, before that, he would prosecute many of the supposed loyalists who supposedly had helped the enemy during the British occupation. Mm-hmm. And he would have two Quakers hanged on the Philadelphia Common. Mm-hmm. And this horrified Philadelphians on both sides. There was a petition with thousands of names on it, including many Continental officers, that said, don't do this. But the radicals felt that if your loyalty was in question, you had to pay the price. And so there was this divide between the constitutionalists, the radicals, and the conservatives, who called themselves the Republicans. And the constitutionalists were in power. And Arnold aligned himself with the conservatives, and so Reed was out to get him. And he had no proof of Arnold's nefarious business dealings, but that did not prevent him from conducting what was essentially a witch hunt.
That's Nathaniel Philbrick, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. He's been a guest in the past talking about our history, American history, and his new book, again called Valiant Ambition, George Washington, Benedict Arnold, and the Fate of the American Revolution. I don't think we have to give too much away. We kind of know how this story ends, but nonetheless, some very fascinating details and questions, I guess, raised about why Benedict Arnold did what he did. Not a justification, but I think a further explanation. 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and stay with us. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen, talking with Nathaniel Philbrick about the fascinating relationship between Benedict Arnold and George Washington and what he calls the Civil War inside the Revolutionary War that was going on in our early history. And again, he's got a new book, and it is called Valiant Ambition. Let me get, looks like Irene from Germantown to join our conversation. Irene, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Well, hi. Hi there. Thank you for taking the call.
You're welcome.
I wanted to say that I have not yet read Valiant Ambition, but I can't wait, and I'm going to. Mr. Philbrick, I just wanted to ask you a question. When you were talking about how the Continental Army was in, they had no money. It was just a terrible time. You know, they just didn't have a lot of money. But I have researched this, you know, as an amateur for years. I'm interested in the Revolution. I'm pretty aware that Benedict Arnold, who was much maligned, especially by that guy, General Gates, the politician, used his own personal fortune. He was from Connecticut, to finance his original campaigns. You know,
yes.
All those boats and flotillas that he built, and he left from Newburyport, Mass., and he went up to, like, fight. That was his own money.
Yeah.
Thanks, Irene. Yeah,
go ahead. That's a very good point, Irene. You know, Arnold had you know, he was a fairly wealthy man in New Haven, and a lot of that money had gone towards the American cause. And what infuriated him was that when he asked to get reimbursed for his expenses while in Canada, which were considerable, the Continental Congress basically just sent him from committee to committee to committee, and you know, he just got no justice, and so that embittered him. Mm-hmm. And then there was the 1-2 punch when it came to Philadelphia was the Pennsylvania legislature and Joseph Reed, who was out to basically persecute Arnold for what he was doing as far as business deals and things like that. And so, Arnold was not an evil person to begin with. I mean, I think that's a surprise for a lot of people, because he's become the byword for a traitor.
Treason.
To be called a Benedict Arnold is to be guilty of the blackest of sins. And Arnold, suffered greatly in this revolution, and what he ultimately did, there's no excuse for it, because he did this because they paid him very well for it when it came to his ultimate treason. He didn't do it completely out of conscience, or at least he wouldn't have explained it that way, but that's the truth. But I think it's Americans need to realize that when it comes to this person who's become such an important part of our natural mythology, there were reasons why he was pushed to do this, and there were reasons that all Americans shared one way or another.
But you're not saying that we should not condemn him for his treason.
Absolutely not.
But just that we need to understand why he did what he did.
Right. Yeah, because the fact of the matter is Arnold was a controversial figure. The seeds for his treachery were latent within his character in hindsight. But he was a lightning rod. And so when he came to Philadelphia, he became this focus of all these issues that were way beyond him. These were states' rights. Joseph Reed threatened to withhold the state's militia and wagons from the Continental Army if the Continental Congress didn't do what he demanded when it came to his persecution of Arnold. Arnold was kind of baffled and completely flustered and angry about all this, and it just pushed him to the brink. And so, but what he would do was, he would turn his back on everything he had held dear, and he would suffer the consequences.
Well, in fact, you write, treason along with suicide is the most self-centered of acts, unmoored from his past and without as of yet a future. This was after he did what he did. Arnold was now the loneliest man on God's earth.
Yeah. Well, there was a lot of narcissism in Benedict Arnold. I think it contributed to how great he was in the battlefield, that, he believed what he was going to do was going to succeed and people would follow him. He was a tremendously charismatic and forceful presence. And so he, when it came to his marriage to Peggy, his treatment by Continental Congress and the state legislature, he began to feel that his country was falling apart. And that it was time for the British to come back, that his country didn't deserve their independence. And so as he would later say, he believed there was just no way we were going to win this war, and that he was actually doing his country a favor by bringing the British back potentially with less bloodshed. That does not change the fact, however, that he insisted on getting very well paid for it.
Well, sounds like you're saying he felt betrayed by America.
Yes, right. And, we're a country where dissent is a big part of this country. We disagree. That's part of the political process. That's how the will of the people is transmitted to politicians. But when does an act of protest go from, something that is constructive to undermining the integrity of our government?
But as you say, he was well paid.
He was well paid. And, right. and that's where there's really no excuse for it.
Let me get Rick from Irene. Thanks for the call. We've got Rick calling us from Warminster. Rick, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yeah. I thought of interest is the fact for your listeners, and I'm sure the author knows it, but at West Point Cemetery, there's actually a tombstone with a left boot. And that is in recognition of when he was wounded before he had become known as a traitor.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah, go ahead.
Right. There's a picture in my book of the boot monument. It's actually at the Battle of the Saratoga Battlefield, and it makes no mention. It's a very moving monument, and it's where in the vicinity of where Arnold fell. In the Battle of Saratoga, and it makes no mention of his name, it alludes to, the greatest general in our army was here.
Yep.
And when you go to West Point, his name has been banished. It's you know, it's the name that will not be spoken. And I think that's a real indication of you know, how Arnold went from the heights to the absolute black depths. And that's really the arc that this book traces. It, you know, it begins with him at his height, right. Arnold at his low point, and then traces him to when his life completely unravels.
But you seem to be saying in this book is that it was his betrayal that somehow brought the country together.
Absolutely. I mean, this is the great tragic irony of Arnold's life. In the first years of the revolution, there was no one short of Washington who did more for the American people in fighting this war of independence. But it would be as a traitor when in 1780, after 5 years of war, he decides to try to turn over West Point to the British. It was unsuccessful, but the news of this galvanized the country. Here in Philadelphia, Arnold would be burnt in effigy, and that would occur in several towns up and down the Atlantic seaboard. And this was a wake-up call to a people who had, you know, many of whom had basically turned their back on this war. You know, let the French win it for us. You know, I'm not going to serve. We're not going to pay for it. And this was a wake-up call that, you know, the real enemy was not Great Britain. It was themselves. This was what was going to bring down the republic. It was going to be people who under the guise of patriotism, tried to undermine Americans' commitment to one another, and that's a continuing challenge to America today.
Your book ends, but it ends not with his death in England. It ends in a really interesting sort of enigmatic point.
Yes. Well, you know
maybe
what?
Think there's another book here.
Yep.
Is there?
The story will continue. It ends with General Nathanael Greene, who is really Washington's most trusted officer. By 1780, with Arnold's betrayal, it's never been worse for America. The British have had several successes to the south. We could lose this thing. And so Washington sends Greene down, and guess who the British will be sending down to Virginia, but none other than Benedict Arnold. And so, it ends somewhat.
Kind of a cliffhanger.
It's a cliffhanger.
An email from Kevin says, what was Arnold's attitude towards his fellow country after America won independence? Did he ever regret his treason?
Well, you know, it's interesting. Washington, after hearing, it's just this hit Washington in a terribly, you know, personal way. I mean, when he first learned of it, he turned to Lafayette, the young French general who had become kind of a surrogate son to him. And he said, whom can we trust now?
Yeah.
And then later, when all his officers were bubbling with the news, one wrote to him that Arnold must have his mind must be in torture, and he said, "No, Arnold, that's not Arnold's makeup. He never has regrets. He just moves forward." And that's absolutely true. Part of his narcissism was that, you know, he never looked back. He just kept moving forward. That did not prevent, however, his life from going in a very sad direction after the revolution.
Did his, though, treason put troops at risk? I mean, the soldiers that had...
Yes.
Had fought for him.
Absolutely. If he had been succeeded, because he was commander at West Point, if it had succeeded, all 3,000 of the soldiers there at West Point would have been captured by the British. He saw this as he didn't foresee large bloodshed because this would lead to a reconciliation. That was his approach. That, however, is not how Washington saw it. And he would almost immediately, once Arnold had escaped to British-held New York, would send an American soldier undercover, under the guise as a deserter, with the job to get Arnold, get him out of New York, and we're going to hang him. It didn't happen. But it's just an index of what Washington's feelings were concerning the general whom he had respected as much as anyone in his army.
Yeah. Let me read some more comments. A tweet, was Benedict Arnold feeling the same disillusionment with American politics as some of us today feel so that he switched sides? I mean, that's a piece of his own frustration.
Yeah. You know, it's always dangerous to compare present with past times because the circumstances were completely different. But that said, I think, you know, we have a tendency to look at the past as a simpler time, you know, particularly when it comes to the founding of our nation, that, you know, they knew where, you know, these were men who knew what they were fighting for, and it was God ordained what they accomplished. And that's not the case at all. It was chaotic, jumbled. They were making it up as they went along, just like we are today. And, you know, some of us are kind of appalled by where the political debate has gone in recent months. Well, it was just as bad, if not worse, when it came to politics during the revolution and in the years after. I mean, this is kind of the nature of this country. And I think, you know, we began in a revolution, and we're always going to be in a state of revolution. That's how we determine what we as a people want to happen. It's not pretty. It's messy, but somehow it works.
Well, someone said democracy is hard, right?
It's very hard, and it's very frustrating, particularly if you're George Washington trying to run an army with any kind of efficiency.
An email from Alexis. What do you think of the AMC show called Turn Washington Spies? Have you ever watched that?
I haven't. I've been asked this question
really?
By many people. And you know, it started last year, and I was in the midst of writing this book, and I couldn't go there. My engagement with the primary sources was what I was focusing on. I couldn't allow, you know, to be distracted by, you know, another interpretation. But I have to say the book, Washington Spies, that Turn is based on by Alexander Rose, is great and was a big help to me. But I haven't seen the series.
An email from Hillary. She says, my mother does our family genealogy, and we may be related to Benedict Arnold.
Yes.
How often have you heard that on a book? I even said that to you myself.
My book, you know, it's only been 3 days since the book came out, and I've been, let's see, at two different book signing events, and I've heard that from two different people. And, you know, the Arnolds were very big in Rhode Island, and then they spread out to Connecticut and beyond in New England. So there are a lot of them out there.
There's a character that appears throughout this book, a guy named Joseph Plum Martin.
Yes.
How did you find him?
Well, Joseph Plum Martin is really one of my favorite characters in this book. He was a common soldier, a kid, a 16-year-old kid from Connecticut, who signs up to serve in the Continental Army. And he's kind of like Forrest Gump, where whenever anything happened,
He's there. Wow.
And late in life, he would write an account of his experiences in the Continental Army. He had clearly kept very detailed notebooks because he's completely reliable in terms of dates and what happened. And he's wonderfully intelligent and skeptical of his superior officer. So, you know, he's just got – and he's everywhere. And he's here in Philadelphia. He's on at Fort Mifflin. An incredible siege that followed the British occupation of Philadelphia. He's there on the Hudson River when Arnold decides to turn traitor. This is kind of a Shakespearean story I tell, but Joseph Plum Martin is the Greek chorus to mix the metaphor a little bit. This is the everyman, the story he tells of the deprivations they suffer. I mean, it's just incredible. Yeah. They never have enough food. They literally don't have clothing. You know, he's there at Valley Forge, they had an even worse winter at Morristown and in 1779, 1780, and Joseph Martin was there. And I think it's important to realize that, you know, we may it's the officers that get the press, but it's soldiers like Joseph Plum Martin who really made it happen. And so his voice is a very important one in Valiant Ambition.
Well, Nathaniel Philbrick, thank you once again for joining us today in Radio Times. You were here a couple of years ago, now back talking about your new book, Valiant Ambition. Thanks so much.
Oh, I've really enjoyed it. Thank you.
Us as well. And again, the book called Valiant Ambition, subtitled George Washington, Benedict Arnold, and the Fate of the American Revolution. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times. You can find out much more about this program. You can download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, and follow us on Twitter. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, and the show is produced by Debbie Builder, Emily Bryant, John Ahrens, and Liz Fiedler. I'm Marty Moscow, and thank you so much for joining us.